Okay, there was a request to start class with a one-minute paper. And so I am going to do that in the sense that I'm going to remind you that next week I have this person coming to give a guest lecture who is a meteorologist for the Air Force and then trained as a physicist and is giving lectures about the science behind atmospheric CO2 and the greenhouse effect. So what I want you to do for Tuesday, he's coming on Tuesday, it turns out. Bring a one-minute paper that is some question that you could ask him about. Could be about climate science. Could be about CO2. Could be about ice ages, whatever. Ecological effects of warming, whatever you want. This guy's supposedly an expert on climate issues, so just bring a question or two that you can ask him, and then turn him in at the end of class.
So do you want us to have the paper already written?
Yeah, so have it already written and bring it to class on Tuesday. So this is going to happen on Tuesday. And then Thursday of next week, we'll do an exam review. And that will include topics from this last unit, but also if you have questions about previous topics, that's certainly fair game. It will be useful to you to bring your old exams for that. If you have questions about what the answers to particular questions were, we can do that. Exams are useful to study from, so if you lost your exam and you would like another copy, you can send me an email and I'll just add it as an attachment. Also, on Thursday of next week, your case study assignment is due. That's this green handout that I gave you. If you lost it, I have extra copies up here, or you can download it from the website. If you would like to save paper, since this is about the ecological footprint, and you can write small enough to put numbers and stuff next to these questions, or just write on the back. You can just turn this in if you want. Are there any questions about this assignment? Has anybody started to do it yet? I know Sarah has. Okay, so last class, we were talking about landscape ecology, and just by way of review, landscape ecology deals with regional scale patterns and processes. And often, landscape ecologists are interested in quantifying the structure of the landscape. So what does that mean? The fractals are part of that. So they were interested in first knowing what types of elements there are. In other words, what types of patches are there? Be they forest patches or aquatic ecosystems or grasslands or urban landscape patches. And then What is the shape of these elements? And Shaylin mentioned one way that shape is measured is using fractal geometry. But another way of measuring shape would be comparing the perimeter of the shape to a circle, understanding how much edge there is. And these aspects of shape are important for what sorts of reasons, do you think? Well, in some sense, the shape of the patch is going to affect how that patch interacts with the adjacent patch. So, for example, if this was our landscape patch, let's say this is forest, and out here is an ag field, the shape of this perimeter here, there's effectively more contact between these two patches because there's not a straight edge there. And some organisms are edge specialists where they're using, say, one patch type for shelter and another habitat type for forage. Other organisms are they don't care too much for the edge. They prefer to be in the center of things, and so they'll avoid edges. Yeah.
So when you're using the Euclidean geometry, does that not take into account those edges? Is that what makes the fractal geometry better?
In some instances, yes. So the question is, well, why is fractal geometry more useful than Euclidean geometry? You can calculate this area in meters squared, just as you could calculate this area in meters squared. And for some instances, that would be okay. But if you're interested in knowing what the edge really is, this edge is not a straight line, and so Euclidean geometry doesn't quite get at that. And the example in your text of why that might be useful is if an organism like an eagle, in the textbook example, is using the edge habitat, in that case a coastline, you get a different sense of what the habitat availability is if you use fractals versus if you just used a straight line distance.
So when you're using the fractal geometry, is there, because you were talking to us on Tuesday about if you use like a 1 meter or a 2 meter or a 10 meter ruler, mm-hmm. Is there a set?
It depends on the organism that you're studying. So you have to scale your ruler to the scale at which the organism uses its environment. And that's tricky sometimes. Landscape ecology also, as we discussed, asks how does the structure affect community composition? So that's getting at the sizes of patches and how they're configured in space. How does it affect dispersal? And how does it affect nutrient flows and cycling? So that's basically what we talked about on Tuesday. The last few examples deal with how does the structure of the landscape change and how might that influence these other aspects of ecology. And landscape structure can change on a variety of scales. One way that it can operate is on the scale of geologic time. And this example from your textbook is coming from the Tucson Mountains, just outside of Tucson, Arizona. And there are, so here are the mountains. They're quite high elevation, over 10,000 feet. There's a pretty famous astronomical observatory there, up there. But in the foothills, there are these types of environments where you have, for example, a wash or an arroyo, which is a stream bed that floods only when it gets a lot of rain. And the soils in this wash are young, so they're 10,000 years old. You have some Pleistocene soils. These are older by 1,000 years. Some from the early Pleistocene and some from the mid to late Pleistocene. And this geological difference here results in changes in the soil composition. So here are the young soils. You can see that there's not much of an organic horizon in any of these soils. Desert soils typically don't have very much organic horizon. And in particular, there's very little clay in these young wash soils. So here's a schematic with depth of the percent clay. It never gets above about 20%. That's right down here. In contrast, these older Pleistocene soils have a fair amount of clay with depth here and here. And they also contain this layer of caliche, which is calcium carbonate. And that is formed through water percolation and deposition of calcium carbonate deeper in the soil. And it forms what some people call hardpan soil, whereas you're digging into it, you hit the caliche layer, and then it's just like you have this layer of chalk, and it's difficult to dig through. So the structure of this soil is going to affect the types of plants that can live there. And interestingly, this plant, the creosote bush, dominates on these Holocene soils and also on some of the Pleistocene soils. And ambrosia, which is the four-winged salt bush, is dominant on soils of this intermediate age, and part of that has to do with the depth to bedrock. And the creosote is living on these earlier Pleistocene soils, but only on the slopes that are more erodible, and so they have less of that caliche and less clay. So these creosote bushes prefer soils that don't have a lot of clay and don't have the caliche. They have to have a deep root, whereas these four-winged salt bushes don't. So in some senses, landscape ecologists need to know something aside from, you know, what these patches are now, but they want to know why those patches are there, and in some cases it might have to do with the geologic history of the area. Organisms can also affect landscape scale change, and one of the best examples of this is the beaver that inhabited North America and was virtually extirpated, but they're making a good comeback. And what you can see in this example, this is from a study in the Northeast where beaver were reintroduced to a forest environment in the mid-1920s. And beaver, of course, build beaver ponds, right? Well, aside from impacting the stream on which they're building this pond, they also generate large amounts of meadow environments, both moist meadows and wet meadows. So these are wetland type environments. And the presence of beaver changes the structure of the landscape by building these dams. So not only do you have the pond and the stream and the forest is declining, but you've got the development of this wetland habitat. Disturbance can also affect landscape structure. And this example comes from the Mediterranean climate of Southern California and Northern Mexico, where you have this type of vegetation that's dominated by low stature live oak trees. These are trees that they're not deciduous. And fire is an important disturbance in this type of landscape. It used to happen fairly regularly, where you'd have, you know, smaller areas being burned during lightning storms and that type of thing. And through human activity, particularly in Southern California, fire suppression has been a management tool in these forest areas. And the thought was that this fire management was actually decreasing the total area of fire burns in Southern California, where you have a large population. Similar vegetation occurs in Baja California. And in this example, they're comparing the total area burned. Baja California doesn't have a strict fire management protocol to that in Southern California. And you can see here that the total area burned is about the same, despite the fact that there are management issues going on in Southern California where they're trying to suppress fires. And there aren't fires as often in Southern California, but their spatial extent is twice as large as it is in Baja California, where you can see it's Baja California, the size of a fire is about half of the average fire size in Southern California. So the result here of management is to increase the intensity of these fires and spatial extent of them. And that's the end of the landscape chapter. So we have one more topic, and that is global ecology / global change. And in this lecture set that I posted on the class website, I have some of the climate greenhouse effect data on there, and I left those on there so that you have them. But Dr. Davies, who's coming on Tuesday, is likely going to use similar information, so I'll just skip through those today. So what is global change? Well, it's in the news a lot, but that's referring to only some aspects of global change, in particular human impacts on global ecology. But global change also can refer to things like seasonal and interannual climate variability that is not due to human activity, and climate change over decades to centuries related to glaciation cycles. That's also not anthropogenic. What's in the news a lot is changes to global biogeochemical cycles like carbon through atmospheric CO2 increases, nitrogen through doubling of the amount of biologically reactive nitrogen. Phosphorus is an element that we didn't talk about, but 3 to 4 times more biologically available phosphorus is entering the biosphere through human activity. Changes in ozone, which is an atmospheric compound related to the emission of chlorofluorocarbons, is important. And then changes in land use affects both terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems. So this is what ecologists mean by global change. With regards to human impacts on global change, this schematic comes from your book, and it actually comes from an article by a guy named Peter Vitusik. But basically the idea is that through human population growth and industrial activities and agricultural activities, humans are impacting the globe in a lot of different ways. And the size of the arrow in this diagram reflects basically the size of the impact. So through industry in particular, you have increases in atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration, which is related to global warming. Agricultural impacts change land use and land cover. This feeds back onto global climate change through changes in CO2 and a loss of biological diversity. Industry and agriculture both contribute to the increase in nitrogen, and that influences biological diversity and to some extent climate change also.
All these are on a global scale.
All these are on a global scale, but also they're also on a regional scale too. But when we're talking about these changes in biogeochemistry, that's measured more at a global scale. So how might changes in nitrogen biogeochemistry affect global warming? It's not some, yeah, Cody.
Restrictions are enhancing plant growth.
The
nitrogen restricting is enhancing plant growth.
The nitrogen restricting is enhancing plant growth?
Depending on whether it's lack.
Yeah, that's not one that I had thought of. One aspect of change in the nitrogen cycle is adding a lot of nitrate to waters and soils. And in the process of denitrification, one product that's a trace product is N2O. And N2O concentrations have been increasing. And N2O is a greenhouse gas because of its structure. So it's similar to water. It's a polar molecule. And polar molecules, because of their bonding structure, trap heat. And so N2O is one of the greenhouse gases that's changing. Everybody talks about CO2, but a lot of other gases are changing too. So that's the explanation for that. I didn't talk about that before, so I wanted to mention it. So let's just briefly talk about what the structure of the atmosphere is. So we live in the troposphere, and about 12,000 or 12 kilometers above the sea level is where the ozone layer is. It's at the boundary between the troposphere and the stratosphere. So ozone is discussed as an atmospheric pollutant when we're living down here in the troposphere through automobile emissions and that type of thing. So people think of ozone as not being a good thing, but we need ozone in the stratosphere because it protects against UV radiation. And the atmosphere's layers have different temperatures because of the way that solar radiation is absorbed. So the red line here is atmospheric pressure. And once you get to the stratosphere, it's rapidly approaching zero. But we have temperature in degrees Celsius, average atmospheric temperature in degrees Celsius over here, and you can see that it declines to negative values pretty rapidly through the troposphere. It warms up to some extent in the stratosphere and then cools way off. And then up at the very top of the atmosphere, it's very warm. The atmosphere is important in global ecology for a lot of different reasons. One is temperature, but the others are wind patterns and ocean circulation and establishment of precipitation. So here's just kind of a schematic of the atmosphere and radiation. So here's incoming solar energy. Half of it is either reflected or absorbed in the upper atmosphere. About 45% is absorbed by the surface, 5% is reflected. So we have a net reflection of about 30 if you include what's going on at the top. This absorption by the surface results in warming of oceans and the generation of oceanic and wind currents. You have convection currents, which are evaporation and then precipitation that kind of cycle a little bit of energy. Latent heat and water, or evaporation, is an important flux back to the atmosphere. And particularly at night, a large amount of energy is re-radiated from the surface. And in the troposphere, we have the gases like N2O and CO2 and methane that reabsorb some of this re-radiated heat. And the atmospheric gases are important because it maintains the temperature of the surface at a livable level. Yeah?
When they started first studying the climate change and so forth, what was the amount of absorbed energy by the surface?
You mean in terms of how much was absorbed by native lands as opposed to... I have a graph at the end that talks a little bit about that. So let's first talk about seasonal and interannual climate variability. And understanding this in an ecological context is because it helps us to forecast some level of change ecologically and climatically. But you know that climate is difficult to predict even on a three-day level. And understanding this also helps to form kind of a baseline knowledge of what the variability is in ecological systems. And there are two scales of what would be considered natural climate variability. The first is occurring at about decadal scales, and these are ENSO cycles. ENSO stands for the El Niño Southern Oscillation. There are similar types of climatic cycles like the Pacific Decadal Oscillation and North Atlantic Oscillations, but I'll just talk about ENSO, because we're impacted by it to some extent in Utah. And then at large time scales, hundreds of thousands of years, are Milankovitch cycles, which were proposed as a mechanism by which glaciation events were triggered. And while it's still accepted today, there was a recent paper that was suggesting that it might not be quite as simple as this model, but we'll present it this way anyway. So, the El Niño Southern Oscillation has to do with ocean temperatures precipitation, wind patterns, and atmospheric pressure. And in the northern hemisphere, our winter precipitation is impacted, and in the southern hemisphere, their southern precipitation is impacted by ENSO. And does anybody know where the name El Niño comes from? Well, in Spanish, El Niño means the boy, and in Catholic Spanish-speaking countries, El Niño is often the term used to describe the Christ child. And El Niño starts to happen in around December, around Christmas time. And off the coast of Peru, here, during El Niño, there's often a large increase in the fish abundance that local peoples catch off the coast. And so they viewed it as kind of a Christmas gift. And that's why it's called El Niño. This process is called El Niño. But what happens, you can see here in terms of ocean temperatures during El Niño, which is a warming phase across the equatorial Pacific. So you can see this is the Pacific Ocean, and you can see this red is the surface ocean temperature at the equatorial region. You can see it's very warm all throughout the whole equator. The opposite side of El Niño is now termed La Niña, the girl, because you can see the warmer waters are all bunched off here in the eastern Pacific, or western Pacific, so off of Indonesia and Australia. So during the warm water goes throughout the equatorial Pacific, and during La Niña, the warm water is only in the western Pacific. How do you think that might affect precipitation? If it's warmer, it should rain more. There should be more evaporation. So what's going on during El Niño is you have a lot of convection cells generating across the entire equatorial Pacific. So you have a wider distribution of precipitation. During La Niña, you've got severe precipitation over Indonesia, but not over the rest of the equatorial Pacific. So here's kind of a schematic of how wind and precipitation are changed as a result of these changes in the surface temperature. During La Niña, this is on top, the top now is La Niña, the warm water is centered off the coast of Indonesia, so you've got a lot of precipitation going on there, and wind is keeping the precipitation over Indonesia, the trade winds. During El Niño, these trade winds weaken, and so this convection and warm water is allowed to go more over the entire equatorial region. And this affects the depth of the thermocline in the ocean. The thermocline is where you have the most rapid temperature change with depth in the ocean. And under normal conditions, so this is not El Niño or La Niña, you have a deep thermocline throughout the western to the middle Pacific. So here's Hawaii. And then here's a shallow thermocline. And you have convection cells that go in this arena. During La Nina, the trade winds are stronger, and they push this warm water farther to the west. So you can see that the thermocline, the shallow thermocline is more pronounced in the eastern Pacific. And then during El Nino, this entire equatorial region is all warm. There's not a shallow thermocline here. So how does that affect normal conditions, baseline? So what is causing this? Well, it has to do with changes in atmospheric pressure in the eastern Pacific Ocean. And it's measured in, atmospheric pressure is measured in Tahiti and at Darwin, Australia. And the index is basically the difference between those two. And when you have positive values, you have higher barometric pressure in the eastern Pacific Ocean. So you have higher pressure off the coast of Peru. Negative values indicate lower barometric pressure in the eastern Pacific Ocean in that equatorial warm water moves to the east. And the periodicity, or how often this switches back and forth, is about every 2 to 4 years it swings between these two. And during El Nino, we have this low pressure here in the eastern Pacific. So when you have higher barometric pressures, you're having La Nina. Yeah, that's what I said. When you're having lower barometric pressure, yeah, you have El Nino. So we have this low pressure here off the coast of Alaska. This is what happened this year, this winter. What it does to the jet stream in North America is it makes a very strong jet stream that's kind of flat along the 30 degree latitude. And that brings a lot of warm moisture from the Pacific. So in this area here where it's green, tends to be wetter than average conditions. So we know in southern Utah they had a lot of snow this year. And part of that is because of the way the jet stream was tracking, because the El Nino was in effect. Other areas, such as the northern latitudes of the U.S. and southern Canada, southern Alaska, are warmer than average because this polar jet stream is blocked. More typically, the area around the Ohio Valley is drier than normal during El Nino in North America. During La Nina, you have a high pressure system developing here on the eastern Pacific, and that blocks the polar jet stream from going up this way. And so it's kind of variable depending on the strength of this high pressure. It could be up going way up here, or it could be going more like that. The Pacific jet stream is more variable and tends to move a little bit farther north than during El Nino. So the Pacific Northwest during La Nina is wetter than normal. And the southwestern U.S. and southeastern U.S. are drier than normal. Evan?
Now, is there a distinguished pattern between
the last year? Is there a boundary between?
No, is there a pattern, like through the past 100 years? Has there been a pattern of El Nino year versus the last year?
Yes.
Increasing more of
In other words, is it becoming more variable? Yeah, no, I don't think so. Because if you look at this graph here, which is showing the index, it's not really changing the periodicity is not really changing. In Utah, you guys were probably too young to remember this. 1983 was a big El Nino year. Was anybody born before 1983? Oh, good. Do you remember what happened in 1983 in the winter? Huh? You got a lot of snow, and in Salt Lake City, State Street was flooded. And Interstate 15 was flooded because there was a rain on snow event in the late winter. And Great Salt Lake levels rose, and there was just a lot of water. Big El Ninos typically occur every 5 to 7 years. So some of the ecological effects of El Nino. It affects the net primary productivity in the Pacific Ocean because the depth of the thermocline affects the upwelling. And when you have strong trade winds pushing water away from South America, you tend to have more upwelling and the thermocline is shallower. In Utah, in 1983, there was the Great Salt Lake that had huge floods. And an ecological consequence of that, you had a large input of fresh water into the Great Salt Lake, which reduced the salinity. And that caused a trophic cascade in the brine shrimp and other community in the Great Salt Lake. And Wayne Wurzbach studied that effect. So this top graph shows the salinity of the Great Salt Lake before the El Nino, then during the El Nino, and post-El Nino. So you can see that it drastically reduced the salinity in the Great Salt Lake. And the three trophic levels that he studied were Charyxids, which are a type of invertebrate that are predators. And they're normally not very abundant in the Great Salt Lake. They do live in Farmington Bay, but Farmington Bay has more fresh water than the rest of the Great Salt Lake. And then he studied a bunch of grazers and chlorophyll, the primary producers. So what he observed was when the salinity levels decreased, that allowed the Charyxids to population to go gangbusters, and they moved into the lake from areas like Farmington Bay that were more fresh water. And the presence of these predators decreased the grazers, especially Artemia, which is the main grazing zooplankton in the Great Salt Lake. Artemia are the brine shrimp. And here's just the overall grazing rate, like how much water they're processing through their bodies per day. So you can see that the grazing rate decreased a lot during the El Nino. It rebounded, though. And as a result of the reduced grazer populations, chlorophyll A in the phytoplankton increased significantly. So this is an example of an ecological effect of El Nino that's kind of close to home. Through evaporation. Yeah, so the inputs to the Great Salt Lake are river water. There's no outflows other than precipitation or evaporation. So over time, the fresh water evaporates.
So this was 1982 and 83?
Well, the El Nino started in December of 82. And then extended into 83. The big floods were in January of 83, I think. I think so.
I was living in Arkansas in December of 82. We got a flood there that washed out
Huh. Yeah. Shaylin.
Now, I'm kind of just looking at this salinity, and wouldn't it be more difficult to evaporate the fresh water compared to the more saline water?
Well, it is. The water is saline. It's even at this level, it's still more saline than the ocean. It just decreased the salinity enough for these Corixids to grow. And I'm not sure how long, what year these data, the post-El Nino, were from. In the southern hemisphere, El Nino induces drought in the southern hemisphere, and La Nina induces flooding. And this is an example of what happens to the kangaroos in Australia during El Nino. So here's the 82-83 El Nino. There was a severe drought, and it induced high rates of mortality among the red kangaroos. About 6 years later, there was a La Nina, and so they're starting to rebound after that. So those are some examples of El Nino. A longer scale climate pattern is the Milankovitch cycles. And the Milankovitch cycle is this graph, which is showing the time on this axis before the present, and then this axis is cut off, but it's a measure of the isotopic signature of ice. And it's measuring the global ice volume. And so if we're up above 4 on this axis, there's less ice globally. And down here, there's more ice globally. And what this graphic shows is there's kind of a 100,000 year cycle between major ice ages. And so this Milankovitch cycle has been attributed to this pattern here, which is cut off by the slide. Is thought to be due to the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit around the Sun. That's the top panel. And what eccentricity means is kind of how wide the orbit is around the Sun versus if part of it was squished. So if this is the Sun, if we're looking at it from a top version, is the Earth's revolution around the Sun more oval, or is it slightly more round? That's an exaggerated view of what that means. But the effect of how narrow this oval is or how round it is affects a small extent of how close the Earth is to the Sun. So when it's more eccentric, when it's more narrow, that kind of squishes the Earth farther away from the Sun. You can think of it that way. So here it's more round. The Earth is slightly closer to the Sun. Yeah. The path is not identical from year to year. It changes a little bit. And I'm not sure, you know, in kilometers how much it changes per year. Milankovitch was arguing that it was the eccentricity cycle that was responsible for initiating ice ages, because its scale is about 100,000 years, where it goes from being super close to super far. So he was arguing that. Other scientists have suggested that this might trigger ice to form more in the northern hemispheres, but these other aspects of how the Earth's orbit is changing probably play into the Milankovitch cycles that are observed also. And one of these is called the obliquity cycle. This happens on about every 40,000 years. And what the obliquity cycle means, it has to do with the Earth's wobble, essentially. So the Earth is not always rotating on the same axis, essentially. The axis is wobbling. But you can't feel it. And so here's a line that's kind of normal to the center of the Earth, and here's the north and south poles. We know that the Earth is slightly tilted, but sometimes it's more tilted than other times because of this wobble. So when it's the most tilted, the northern hemisphere winters are farthest away from the sun. In other years, there's less of a tilt. And that happens on about every 40,000 years, that it goes swing one from the farthest away to the closest. Yeah, John?
Have they studied determined how much ice we're talking about in these periods with not the greatest ice buildup? Are we talking about ice at the equator or just ice building up on the poles?
The last ice age extended as far south as it extended as far south as New England. You have ice in that time. You'd have ice in glaciers in alpine areas, even as far south as Utah.
So have they determined we have the technology to survive that sort of thing on a global scale, or is it?
Do we have the technology to? I don't know about that area of research. I mean, certainly humans have been exposed to the Little Ice Age in Europe. The last aspect of orbital changes that might contribute to this 100,000-year climate cycle is called the precession of the equinoxes. And the Earth... when the Earth is farthest away from the sun, it's called the apihelion. And in some years, the northern hemisphere is tilted away from the sun when it's farthest away from the sun, when it's at its apihelion. And about every 20,000 years, the northern hemisphere is tilted towards the sun at apihelion. So this is winter. Sometimes the northern hemisphere is tilted farther away from the sun. Sometimes it's tilted towards the sun. Still winter because we're at the farthest point in the northern hemisphere. But the direction that the Earth is moving on its axis is slightly different. It says the northern hemisphere is tilted towards the sun at apihelion. So this is just changed here. So here's the northern hemisphere. The North Pole is tilted towards the sun. Here it's tilted away from the sun. Yeah?
Is our winter now because of the tilt, not because of the distance?
Oh, it comes because of the tilt. Yeah. So the equinoxes change as the Earth is rotating around the sun every 20,000 years. So the thought is that, so Milankovitch was arguing that eccentricity was the most important, but other scientists have argued that these other things probably have something to play into to these glaciation cycles. Atmospheric chemistry, let's get into that right now. The ozone hole. And ecologists call this stratospheric ozone depletion. And it occurs in the polar regions more so than around other places. And these data are showing ozone concentrations. So that this axis is ozone concentrations at the North Pole and at the South Pole. And you can see that, you know, there's some variability here. But it was in the late 1980s in the North Pole that we started to see some decline in North Pole ozone concentrations. And these data points, they're just coming from different samples, basically. Here's another graph for the South Pole, and you can see that it's much more pronounced decline, and it started a little bit earlier. It started in the early 1980s to have this concentration decrease. So why do you think it happens more so at the poles? Well, this is occurring in the stratosphere, so it's occurring way up in the atmosphere. Partly. So it has to do partly with radiation. John?
Is there a weather pattern that takes pollution like 4-4-5-8 from poles and then in latitudes and drops it in the poles?
Yeah, there is an atmospheric wind pattern that tends to concentrate some of that stuff from the stratosphere anyway, up there. And then ice or cold, wet ice precipitation serves as kind of a nucleation, so in the atmosphere there. The way that ozone depletion works, it was in the 1990s, it wasn't really clear what was going on. And the thought was, well, maybe it is chlorofluorocarbons that are doing this. So ozone is a molecule that looks like that. It's just three oxygens that are bound together like that. And chlorofluorocarbons are molecules that have chlorine and fluorine attached to some carbon molecule. And in the stratosphere, what happens is chlorine from this molecule will bind to an oxygen and cut it off. So now we have a chlorine monooxygenase. And that basically eats up the ozone. Chlorine can also attack oxygen and then break off and go and attack more. So not very much chlorofluorocarbon is needed because this chlorine essentially can be recycled and just keep going and attacking all of these things. So there have been some studies on the effect of ozone depletion in ecological systems, effects on human and animal health. Ozone blocks ultraviolet radiation. And so when it's depleted, more ultraviolet radiation hits the Earth's surface, which can cause cancers. And so that's the focus of health issues. People have also studied the effects on plant yield, plant productivity, and on aquatic ecosystems, in particular phytoplankton and organisms that live in surface waters. There was an ecologist here at Utah State named Martin Caldwell who was one of the premier researchers in the ecological effects of ozone depletion. And he conducted most of his work at Tierra del Fuego in Argentina. So the largest ozone hole was observed during the winter. Here's South America, down here in Tierra del Fuego. So the ozone hole was most apparent here. And he examined agricultural systems and also native forests. And they thought, well, there could be whole plant level responses, like changes in growth rates, the form of plants, secondary chemistry. In plants that are irradiated with ultraviolet radiation, they produce more secondary compounds. Secondary compounds are often produced in response to herbivory, but they were also produced in response to this. Decreased yield was observed in some plants. It affects the competitive balance. And because of these secondary compounds, it can affect the quality of plants for, in this case, in agricultural systems for food, but also for other trophic levels in natural ecosystems. In native plant systems, it affected the timing, the phenology of the plant, so when they flowered, how many flowers they produced. That affected the pollinators, which ultimately affected reproduction. It changed the growth, changed the form. Because of the secondary compounds, it affected the herbivory and also diseases. They're allocating more to these secondary compounds, and that having kind of weak growth led to some disease outbreaks, affect composition or competition, which then affected the structure of plant communities, so biodiversity. Because of these secondary compounds, it affected decomposition rates and then fed into nutrient cycling, which then fed into competition. So it had lots of effects that were not necessarily very simple. In aquatic ecosystems, they've been studying effects of UV radiation, in particular UVB, on phytoplankton in experiments and also in marine systems just off of Tierra del Fuego. And they see similar types of things. It affects the motility of phytoplankton. Some phytoplankton have flagella, and they can move up and down in the water column. So when there was higher UV exposure, they tended to migrate down to deeper layers. Other phytoplankton can't do that, so they're more impacted by the UVB. In some cases, their pigmentation. Some pigments can protect against UVB. It decreased the photosynthesis rate, which then changed biomass. The question is, does it affect the food web in the ocean? Does it affect competition? So they haven't answered these questions, but in terms of global responses or regional southern ocean type of responses, is it going to reduce the CO2 sink, which could feed into climate change? Is it going to affect food web in the ocean? Is it going to affect diversity in the ocean? So in the 1990s, there was this policy developed called the Montreal Protocol, which enforced a ban on chlorofluorocarbon emissions. And over time, the ozone hole has been shrinking. There are still some residual chlorine in the atmosphere. It's got a long half-life. But chlorofluorocarbon emissions are significantly reduced, and so the hole has been shrinking. So I'm not going to talk about the greenhouse effect, so I'm skipping all these. I don't know if he's going to talk about this graph, so if he doesn't, be sure to ask me about this on Thursday, because it's kind of a cool graph. So just put a star by it. So as I mentioned before, when we were talking about the global nitrogen cycle, the nitrogen cycle has been altered through a doubling of biologically available nitrogen primarily through fertilizers. And just by way of review, this is a little schematic of the nitrogen cycle. So most of the nitrogen is as nitrogen gas. Through fixation, it become incorporated into plants and bacteria. When these are decomposed, you get ammonium forming, which can then be converted into nitrate, which can then be converted into nitrogen gas. As a consequence of this increase, basically essentially increasing this arrow, actually making an arrow from N2 directly to NH4, we're building up a large amount of biologically available nitrogen as ammonium and nitrate. And nitrogen pollution affects all ecosystems, terrestrial and aquatic. And coastal ecosystems are most often heard about in the news. And this is just showing the concentrations of nitrogen and phosphorus that are being loaded into a bay in Sweden. And here's the nitrogen data. You can see that they're growing. Nitrogen is increasing more so than phosphorus in this bay. And they're getting blooms of filamentous green algae in the mid-1970s, and then really big phytoplankton blooms in the mid-1980s. Overall, estimates of nitrogen fluxes to coastal environments worldwide are between 4 and 11 times of background. What happens as a result of that is an increase in what are called toxic algal blooms in estuaries and coasts. And this can take a variety of forms. Before 1972, these little stars and circles indicate the different sorts of toxic algal blooms that occurred in 1972 and in 1999. So you can see there's quite a few more. There are a variety of kinds that can happen. One is called a brown tide, which is a dinoflagellate that produces a toxin that causes destruction to shellfish beds. You can have poisoning of shellfish themselves that can then be transferred to human food webs if those shellfish are consumed. One particularly devastating type of algal bloom is called Fisteria, and that has happened off the coast of North Carolina and Florida, and it causes extensive fish kills and has harmed humans. Just by touching the water, humans can become ill. There was a famous oceanographer who was studying what caused Fisteria blooms in North Carolina, and she had cultures of these things in her lab, and she had a break in her lab glove and touched the Fisteria and became severely sick. It's a neurotoxin, and she actually died because of her research. A lot of people think that the nitrogen pollution in coastal areas comes from rivers, but that's not necessarily the case. There is atmospheric deposition of nitrogen. And this is just showing a table of all of these areas, coastal areas that have been studied that have elevated nitrogen levels. And in many cases, 30 to 40% is derived from atmospheric deposition. So it's not all just coming down rivers, it's also coming down in precipitation. Groundwater pollution, as I mentioned, is a pretty severe problem in areas where drinking water is derived from groundwater. And this is an area where I worked after graduate school in France. And these circles represent drinking water wells and their nitrate concentration. And the little dot here, dots this size, are greater than the drinking water, the permissible level for drinking water. So you see a lot, most of these people are drinking water that's contaminated with nitrate. Too much nitrogen can cause eutrophication, which is an excess of algal growth. So here's before and after. Can cause fish kills when that stuff, if this isn't even toxic algal bloom, just from having that much biomass, when it decomposes, the oxygen is depleted, and that can kill fish. Here's the picture I told you that I had, but I forgot to bring it that day. This is blue baby syndrome in an adult woman. Can you see her? This is a woman with blue baby syndrome, and this is a different woman. You can see her skin takes on this gray pallor because of consuming too much nitrate. And fish get a similar disease. Here's a normal fish with red blood, and then one that has brown blood disease from too much nitrate. I mentioned before it can contribute to amphibian decline. So here's a three-legged frog through supporting growth of primary producers that carry pathogens to the frogs when they're in their early development. It's also been associated with several cancers, in particular gastric cancer. This is a picture of a gastric tumor. Bladder cancer and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma have all been correlated with high levels of nitrate in drinking water. So I'll end here, and I'll talk about land use change briefly on Thursday, but there's just a couple of slides.